Today, we're going to segment the news conference, starting off with two representatives of World Vision who are participating in a major way in Urbana. And later, Rick and Kay Warren are due to arrive. They're wrapping up another session, so they notified us that they will be late. So we will welcome them when they arrive. And in the meantime, you have plenty of opportunity to question Steve Haas and Princess Zulu. Steve Haas is the vice president with World Vision and is a spokesman for the HIV/AIDS Hope Initiative and other activities related to that. Princess Kasuni Zulu was a native of Zambia. She lost both parents to AIDS and has dedicated her life to the global AIDS fight. You have more information in the press packets that World Vision has provided. There are more over there and some more over there if you need any additional information. And we'll open it up for questions. If you could also identify yourself when you ask a question, that will be helpful. Ruth
Bless Mission Network News. With regard to the Hope Initiative in dealing with the AIDS issues, how is the funding from the World Health Organization and things like that helping with this particular initiative?
I'll go ahead and give it a start. When you talk about 69 million people that have been infected, obviously one program, one organization is not going to be enough to cut it. When you're talking about issues of prevention, advocacy, and compassionate caregiving, obviously there's a need for some pretty heavy lifting. And so currently on programs through the PEPFAR grant, which has been very, very significant to the Bush administration, I think most people know about that, $15 billion over 5 years, in which we're coming to the end of that, but also the great help of the Global Fund and others that are helping do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of programmatic response. I mean, this is absolutely critical. And again, then from that, all the multitudinous organizations that are working together and in some cases separately to impact the pandemic is significant. So again, large dollars for large things that have to do with everything from unclean water, education, the job security, food security. These require large amounts of money.
Are you seeing an effectiveness in these programs? Obviously, you have to say yes, but are you actually seeing some kind of effectiveness and where, in light of the fact that numbers always seem to get bigger?
Yeah, I don't think we have to say yes. I think I can say yes, because it has been yes. We're seeing some wonderful things happen. Was just talking with some programmatic officers in Zambia recently, and they're talking about how the advent of funding from the PEPFAR grant has actually done wonderful things programmatically to reach out to children, especially those who've been disadvantaged due to the loss of both parents. Uganda is also a tremendous success story. There's some question now whether they can maintain that success over time, but they've gone from roughly 22% down to around 5, 6, 7% in terms of persons infected with the disease. That's in large measure because of the internal push, but also the supportive external push of government funding and appropriate programming with reference to the disease.
But you're talking about Africa, and Asia now looks like it's becoming the center of where the pandemic shifted to.
Yeah, Asia in terms of India now is the number one country in terms of AIDS statistics, and some have said that that's the new epicenter. As long as you have roughly 70% of those who are infected still living in sub-Saharan Africa, though, our concentration will probably always be there, but I think significantly there for the time being. Princess?
Are the numbers that we're getting accurate?
Numbers right now are accurate. If anything, they're low. Most of the numbers that are being accounted for are those numbers of things that we can actually track. Keep in mind, two of the biggest killers around HIV/AIDS are stigma and ignorance. There's a reason why someone doesn't want to go to the clinic at 4 o'clock to get tested and find out their status. Typically, it's because other community members are also watching to see who goes in at 4 o'clock to get tested. And to have that branded as you might be somebody who has that disease that kills people in our community is not a good thing. And so in terms of a lot of the statistics, we're still dealing with a stigma and ignorance problem with reference not only to places like Africa and India and China, but I think we also have that problem here in this country. I make it very clear that when I was speaking at universities last year, I spoke on 15 Christian college college campuses, and after 10 of those campuses, I just did a simple survey. This is not something that you could say was a Stanford study, Harvard back. I just said, raise your hands if you have heard the word HIV and AIDS from the church pulpit. Keep in mind, most of the students go to two churches. One, their parents hope, two churches. One where they live when they grew up, where they grew up with their mom and dad, and one on campus. The total number of 10 campuses, roughly 18,000 students, was 28. Why? Why? Now, I can tell you this year, it's a whole different story. We've seen an incredible change. I mean, it's 28 would be low for one campus. Last year, it was 28 for 10 campuses. So there's a whole sea change happening on Christian college campuses as well as secular campuses around this disease. But we've got stigma and ignorance in this country, and it's got to be erased. This is just a disease. It can be prevented. And it is a killer if it doesn't have the appropriate social safety nets and appropriate caring that could be provided by a community.
In the programs that World Vision operates, wherever they are, how do you address the HIV/AIDS issue once it's already taken place? I mean, once someone's been infected, then that's going to be changing a lot of things in that family dynamic. What do you do to look for heart change to try to prevent things from continuing down that path?
Why don't I turn that one over to Princess Zulu in your own community? How would you have answered that? Or what's happened maybe in some of the communities that you've been a part of?
Yeah, I think I want to answer it a little bit from two angles. And one of the angles is to ensure that prevention is always our focus. And that has been a focus for World Vision's Hope Initiative, is to ensure that people realize that even a country like Zambia, whose infection rate is about 16%, the reality means the bigger number of people are still HIV negative. And sometimes that is not spoken about that much. Yes, sub-Saharan Africa is still the epicenter of HIV and AIDS, but I think we also have a lot of people in every African country. The number of those uninfected is larger than those infected, even in countries like Botswana and South Africa, where the infection rate is near to 40%. So I think we have a responsibility as a people, as educators, as organizations, but also as Africans, to not be overwhelmed by the numbers of those living with HIV and AIDS, to understand that there is a big number of people who are still HIV negative and they can be prevented from becoming HIV positive. So I think there has been so much emphasis on those infected, which is good, but I think sometimes we tend to neglect and forget that the bigger number are those people who are actually still HIV negative. Now, coming to those who are already infected, as a person myself who has been living with HIV since I came to know my HIV status in 1997, is to also give a face of HIV and AIDS that has never been given. And many times AIDS has been portrayed of a disease which is already advanced, and of course that's AIDS. But I think we were jumping the situation of HIV, and that is, to me, the most crucial moment. That is a time when people still look beautiful, that is a time when people are still attractive, and that's a time when people infect other people without even knowing they're carrying the virus. That is when somebody just look by at somebody and say they are okay. So I think we had to focus on HIV. What is HIV? Can you tell by looking? Why is it important to do an HIV test in Africa, but as well as in your own country in the United States? Because HIV and AIDS is a global issue, and we have to continue singing the song of Africa's HIV, but more than anything, to understand that this is a global pandemic and it needs a global response. So those are some of the few things we are doing, and of course, ensuring that people like me and others who are HIV positive, who much of who we are has been because of our faith to many of us, is to continue to speak boldly about being positive. I present a program in Zambia called Positive Living. Just how are some of the things that we can do that can help us to live longer? And of course, even sharing our experience, having hope and faith in Christ, how that enhances or extend our living. But we also know that some people come to the Lord because of their situation. And so that has been wonderful to see. And also, of course, the turning around of many governments, many traditional leaders and traditional rulers, as well as many church leaders, to say, we are part of this problem, we are affected as well, or infected, and that has been a huge success.
Are you seeing more of a response then from the churches? I mean, you were talking about a few years ago, a year ago, 28 kids out of 10 campuses said that they heard HIV from the pulpit. But are you actually seeing the community churches reach out and impact in this particular?
Well, we're seeing both here and there. We're about to have Rick and Kay, and Rick and Kay are great friends and have been very vocal about this issue, really starting with Kay. I think they'll certainly give their own spin and story on it as to how that all came about. But we're seeing other church leaders beginning to speak out as well. There's been a tremendous amount of ignorance around this disease in this country, and I think much of it due to a certain filter that in this country we tend to look through when we look at the disease. When you look at the disease internationally, that filter may not be as accurate. And what's happening, I think, is you're seeing a thawing, not only in this country, but also of church leaders internationally about what some have even called a defrosting of attitudes around the disease, to understand that this is a human being. They've been impacted by a disease that will kill them if not treated appropriately. And that just as James 1:27, which is a verse we banter around quite regularly, pure and unadulterated religion is this, that you keep yourself you take care of orphans and widows in their distress. So if you really want to have a pure and unadulterated religion, which is what this conference is about, then you got to take care of orphans and widows in their distress. And the last one says, and to keep yourself from being polluted by the ways of the world. Does that? So you've got this feeling amongst church leaders where they've been given release to begin caring for these people who have been infected and affected by this disease. And as leaders of the church have spoken up, well, then a lot of other leaders who are listening for that kind of music to act are hearing and realizing that they can harmonize in their own specific ways, whether it means locally, internationally, people in their own congregations. And as that happens, that creates movement. And on this one, because we have sat out for so long, somehow that speed of that movement seems to double on itself. And that's what's happened in the past year or two.
And I think maybe to add on a little bit, the church in Africa really came to the table to fight HIV and AIDS because they realized they were infected themselves. Because there was at the beginning, I remember when I tested HIV positive and I wanted to share my story in the congregation. And the first thing my local pastor at that church said, you cannot do that. And I did insist that I wanted to share, because if I as a Christian cannot stand up to say, yes, I may die of this incurable disease, but I still hold on to my faith. I know that God is still faithful, even in this situation. Give hope to those who are already dying, because the reality is there's no cure. Who else would be in a better place? I remember for just being bold enough to do that, the local church said, we are going to excommunicate you from coming to church. You know, and there are many stories of people who are studying to become pastors, and upon being found HIV positive, they were excommunicated. Some were pastors and their salaries were dropped, or they were elders and they were no longer required to be elders. Some were choir members and they were told, you can no longer sing. So that was the history around the church. But I remember vividly saying that there is no better institute or organization that is well equipped than the church. And I think to see a turnaround for the church has been a blessing. But the church had waited so long that until they realized that it affected their members, that the church wasn't left out. So if the church is not left out, some people say then Christ himself is infected, you know. And so to see that change in the church, it's the same change that is affecting even many of our governments. Now, Africa is a continent, not a country, so governments do differ, but many governments also came to the table upon realizing that their own members of parliament who are infected, they are becoming forced to have new members of parliament from time to time, people losing, people being lost because of HIV, even though many of them wouldn't be public about it. But now we are seeing a shift where they are saying, what can we do? How can we do this? From us as World Vision, instead of asking the church to say we want to do something, now the church is always asking us to go and train them. And sometimes you can't even go to all these events or to all these workshops. But that has been a huge success, not only in Africa, but also even here in the U.S. It's a different strategy, but still, again, to see an awakening, which wasn't there, let's say, in 2002, 2000, I think it's an encouragement, but the pace still needs to be increased if we could accelerate a little bit.
Steve Lawson, Charisma Magazine. Given your informal survey of the college campuses, and now here at Urbana they have a track for AIDS, can you address how you see that as being significant? And then also, what do you want students to come away from here with other than a further awareness? What do you want them to do? How do you want them to act?
I think Urbana may be one of the most I hope I'm not prone to overstatement. I don't think I've been accused of that yet. But this may be one of the greatest movements for the church with reference to the fact that these are the future leaders of the church. And these are the ones right now who have grown up with HIV and AIDS their entire life. And the students on campus. So as they begin to speak up and act up in appropriate ways, you're seeing a change in the way in which the church now has to describe itself and position itself with reference to this disease. Acting on AIDS, which is a movement which may be one of the fastest growing movements, a campus movement around today. I think 2 years ago it was one campus. Now it's on a little over 100 campuses nationally in just 2 years. The impact of that has been simply students deciding to do three things. One, that they would get involved in advocacy. Now, the issue of advocacy is critical in light of the fact that there are a number of things happening at government levels which often die just due to lack of public attention. I'll give you a great example. Earmark.
Hey, Rick.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, brother.
Hi, Princess.
Hello.
Long time no see. You guys, you're my favorite people in the whole world. Well, bless you guys.
Thank you.
The earmark for orphans and vulnerable children, which is to be 10% of the PEPFAR grant, that has to be approved yearly. Who's gonna argue for that? Who's going to ask for that? Kids don't speak very loud, especially when they're in Africa, especially when they don't have a mom and a dad. Well, students are speaking about that. Students are writing to congressmen. Students are active. So advocacy is one. One is prevention, that we're asking actually students to live chaste lives, as well as talk about the issue of abstinence and being faithful. What does that mean? How do you act that one out? How do you talk about that one? Three is compassionate care. And that's not just for what's happening in Africa. That's also at the university level for what's happening in your own local community and city. And so many of these students are saying, I'll give time to go sit with somebody. I talked with one student recently, and it was amazing to hear this student on behalf of seven other students who on every Saturday was giving up a fairly large amount of time to simply go sit with somebody who was AIDS infected or HIV infected. This person was in advanced stages. And what did you do? Were you trained for this? No, I just rubbed his feet. I just did my homework. Because if we didn't visit him, there was nobody that visited him. He had no friends. Literally, his at-risk community had disowned him. Everybody else had disowned him. But these students should realize that's not somebody that God would disown, and so they spent time with that gentleman, and it made all the difference for this guy. And a student can do that. So as that's begun to happen, the church begins to have foot and handholds on how they can talk about the issue and how they can get involved. That's only increasing, and that's profound good news.
I'd like to welcome to the news conference the pastor of Saddleback Church and author of The Purpose-Driven Life, Rick Warren, who is also on Good Morning America this morning and gave Urbana a nice plug. We appreciate
We
Rick,
try.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I noticed you're making some notes there. Did you have something that you wanted to say before we open it back up for questions?
No, I was just taking notes on Steve. He never, you know, he always is good, so I just have to write it all down.
Okay, good. Peter.
Peter Helms from New York Seminary. I'm wondering what theological link we can make between the pro-life, pro-family movement and the new evangelical internationalism. So if some said evangelicals are part of the religious right in some sense, with the passion about abortion and gay marriage, and then organizations like World Vision working out of this evangelical missionary stream of relief and development, taking on issues like AIDS and poverty, how can we bring Dr. Dobson on abortion and gay marriage together with Rick Warren on AIDS and poverty as a family and community value that we need to work on?
Go ahead, Princess, you take that one.
Well, I think there was a question that was just asked, and it goes to answering your question in a seminar we just had. And someone said, you know, there's a lot of people in the tent that are standing next to each other that don't appear to maybe agree on everything. And we said, you know, that's right. But we do agree on this. We do agree on God's love for the world. We do agree on the fact that he loves every individual. We do agree on the fact that AIDS can be prevented. We do agree on the fact that it takes our voices to speak up for folks who don't have a voice. I mean, there's a whole... In fact, when we got done with it, okay, here are the things that we disagree on, but man, we got so many things we need to work on that we could agree on. And so I think that's where we start. And that may be different than some people's understanding of what quote-unquote evangelicalism is or has become or whatever, in which it appears they always start with what we disagree with and what we're against. And it's not to say anybody's watering down anything. It is to say that there are a wealth of things we need to be talking about that we actually have a great deal of similarities in. Let's start there and just see what God does in the midst of that.
Yeah. I've been promoting what I call a coalition on civility. Mm. You know, one of my models our life is William Wilberforce, which there's a movie coming out on him in February. And Wilberforce had two primary goals. He first was the man who led the abolition of slavery 200 years ago in the British Empire. And second, he was committed to what he called the reformation of manners in society. Those were his two big goals. And I think that our civilization has lost its civility, that we're just being mean to each other. And I am really tired of the polarization. You do not have a right to demonize somebody just because he's different from you. Jesus said, not only love your neighbor, he said, love your enemies. That is radical love. Not just love your neighbor. He says, love your enemies. And it's really interesting that when someone tries to do that, then you really get the wrath of certain people who really do want to create enemies, because there's actually money behind it. I am not a member of the religious right. I'm not a fundamentalist. I'm an evangelical. And one of the things that many of us have been trying to do is define the terms, that they are not the same. They are not the same at all. But I was talking to a well-known leader of the religious right one time, and he told me, he said, you know, I've discovered that the quickest way to raise money is have an enemy. I'm going, well, I don't think that's a good ethic. I don't think that's a legitimate way to promote your cause. And as I said, the church has been known for what's against instead of what it's for. And I'm tired of that. And I intend to be one of the people to help change it. And one of the things we are for was things that Jesus was for. As Steve and Princess Zulu would talk about, we're for the poor, we're for the sick, we're for the uneducated, we're for ending corruption. What are we against? We're against sex trafficking. We're against the misuse of people. We're against slavery, which is still a real issue in many parts of the world. And so we haven't stopped our opposition to people who want to take life. I'm staunchly pro-life. For pro-lifers to accuse me of something is ludicrous. If you've read chapter 2 or chapter 22 of the Purpose Driven Life, you know that I believe that God had a purpose for your life before you were even born, and that no child is an accident. And so, but if you only can work with people you agree with, that you've ruled out the entire world, because nobody agrees completely with you. My wife doesn't even agree completely with me. And so you have to work with people you disagree with on different issues. But you can disagree without being disagreeable. And you can have unity in certain issues without having uniformity. And Francis Schaeffer taught me this. It was something that actually Wilberforce practiced, but he called it co-belligerency, which is different than simply being an ally. I often use an illustration that, for instance, I'm a co-belligerent with the feminist movement when they're against pornography. When they're against the objectification of women, I'm on their side. Now, I don't agree with a lot of the feminist agenda, but I do agree with that, and I'm a co-belligerent with them. And there are lots of other areas that I would say, you don't agree with me on this, and I don't agree with you on that, but we do agree on this. So let's work together. And I feel that that's important for the church to do.
Steve Lawson.
Hi, Steve.
How are you doing?
Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. There's some who, evangelicals who worry that traditional evangelism is being overshadowed by the word energy about justice, compassion,
right, right.
And causes. Do you worry about that? And what's the place for traditional evangelism, or is there in all of this?
Those who would argue that are arguing that there's only one way to evangelize. And that's like dropping one hook in the water. I believe in trot line fishing, which means you might have a whole string of hooks and you say, this might help someone who's poor. This might help someone who is receiving injustice. This might help somebody who has AIDS. This might help somebody. And so as a church that's baptized 20,000 new believers in the last 10 years, I repudiate that vision and would say I would imagine that some of the churches that are doing social ministry evangelical are seeing greater results than even those who have limited themselves to one form of outreach.
I think it was Ron Sider, really a friend of all this being stated, who said he called that a one-sided gospel. Where we differentiate, we say the gospel is only proclamational in format, and therefore that's the way it is. You gotta say Jesus every fourth word; otherwise, it is not it's not the gospel. Repudiating those over here that say it's only socially impactful. If it's not socially impactful, it doesn't matter if you say Jesus or mention him in any way. Well, he says when we separated those two, we've created a one side. In fact, he said a bastardized faith, and I think that's accurate. The gospel is both; it's always been both. Jesus is our greatest model and our hero in this.
Bible also says it's the kindness of God that leads us to repentance. Mm-hmm. And so I don't see any contradiction. Yeah. There could be. I mean, there could easily be an emphasis one way or the other, but neither would be right. And when you think about that, it was God's kindness that leads us to repentance. Mm-hmm. It just seems logical and right that we would show kindness and love and tenderness to other people, and in so doing, create an opportunity for Jesus Christ to win their hearts, love their hearts.
Here's a soundbite for you. I'm more worried about politics preventing evangelism than I am compassion preventing evangelism. I'm not worried about compassion at all robbing us of sharing the good news. I am worried about political agendas that rob us from sharing the good news and take away our right to share the good news because people disagree with you politically.
Are there any more questions? Peter.
Well, Rick, I was wondering if you could talk more about your interest in Rwanda and how the AIDS issue plays into that, and kind of how you came to a heart for Rwanda.
Well, Kay could talk about this too. Actually, Rwanda chose us. We didn't choose Rwanda. In the peace plan, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, the five things that Jesus did a little bit tomorrow night, we were looking for a national model We were looking for a very small country that we could test it. And we've been testing the peace plan for nearly 3 years now in 68 countries. And we've been testing it where the church is growing rapidly. We've been testing it where there are no churches. We've been testing it where the global giants are the biggest, like poverty, disease, illiteracy. And we wanted to test it in a very small country, see if we could get government, NGOs, business, churches, everybody all to work together in a particular area. And we were actually looking at Namibia, and because it's the population is in two primary centers, as Steve knows. And I got a letter from the president of Rwanda who said, I read Purpose Driven Life, I'm a man of purpose, and we invite you to come to Rwanda and help us develop the peace plan, and we'll do that. So we came in. It's interesting. Since then, other countries have kind of started lining up. I received an email from the Minister of Health of Guatemala saying, can we be next? And I got a letter from the President of the Philippines saying, can we be next? And we're seeing this start to line up. But one of the things that I think is special about Rwanda is because of the genocide, this is a very... This country also will model another major problem, which is reconciliation. And Princess Zulu, Steve, Kate know that all around the world, this is one of the major problems in the world, is the conflict between ethnic groups, religious groups, power groups, and things like that. And if we can model reconciliation in Rwanda, where you have people who killed each other living side by side, not with a fence, not ghettoized, then that can be the model for a lot of other places too.
Amen. Okay, Rick, I ask Steve this, so maybe you can address it as well. What do you see the significance of a conference like Urbana having an AIDS track, putting such emphasis on this at this point?
Well, I'm thrilled about it. Kay, why don't you talk about that first?
Oh, do I have an hour? To have the next generation be concerned, to be informed, to have their hearts engaged, I can't think of anything more thrilling. In my generation, in on our watch, I mean, we were given a pandemic, an epidemic that we allowed to turn into a pandemic. And so to the next generation, these students, these 22,000 students who are sitting here, we are handing them a pandemic. We have failed to stop it. And so they are the ones, it's not going to be stopped. I probably won't live to see the end of HIV. It's probably going to take that much longer to end it. But the next generation, those who are coming up, those in their 20s or 30s, the teens, the kids who are still in elementary school, who can be taught from an early age, that to care about people with HIV, you don't even think about it. Of course you care about people with AIDS. It's just something you do. That it's something that we can take all the way back to the children in our church and encourage them to care and get that heart of God of compassion. And to see that's the only hope of it stopping. It's probably not going to end in my lifetime. So to see 22,000 people, young people who are hearing about HIV, who are going through the AIDS experience in the World Vision thing in the exhibition hall, mm-hmm. to see the information, to see college students getting excited, it is the most thrilling thing I can imagine to know that they are going to get it and they're going to care and they're going to do something. They're not going to just sit on their hands moan about it. They're going to do something.
And not only are they going to do something, only the church can stop this. I fundamentally believe that because there is a component that only the church has the authority to deal with. When Kay and I were at the International Conference on AIDS in Toronto this summer, one of the sessions that we spoke at, I talked about the difference between slowing or stopping the pandemic. When I hear non-church people talking about AIDS, all the things that they're dealing with will slow it, but they will not stop it. And so I always say, tell me what you want to do with this pandemic. Do you want to slow it down, which is a whole lot easier to do and doesn't involve any behavioral change really that much, or do you want to stop it? I'm not interested in just slowing it. I do want to slow it, but more than slowing it, I want to stop it. If you want to slow it, you do four things. And these are the four most popular methods for slowing AIDS. The first is supply condoms. S-L-O-W. Here's a acrostic. S-L-O-W. Supply condoms. Who can doubt that supplying condoms has saved lives? There's no doubt about it. It has saved lives. But will it stop the pandemic? Absolutely not. Because there aren't enough condoms in the world. You can't get them delivered in the world. And there's a certain percentage of failure. It will not stop it. It will slow it. And I'm in favor of slowing, but it's not enough. Supply condoms. Second, the most popular thing is limit the number of partners. And we heard this at the AIDS conference. Well, of course, limiting the number of partners will slow the pandemic. It will not stop it. Because it's not enough just to limit the number of partners. Yes, if I have 5 partners instead of 15, I'm going to slow it. But it doesn't eliminate the pandemic. O and slow is offer needle exchange. Well, who could doubt that needle exchange has saved lives? Of course it's saved lives. You may not have a moral, you may be morally opposed to that, but the fact is it saves lives. As a pastor and as someone who cares about getting people into heaven, I am concerned about keeping people alive at any cost so that I can get the good news to them. And I think that's the ultimate pro-life position, keeping people alive at whatever the cost. Offering needle exchange will slow the pandemic. It will not stop it. And the fourth thing that they say is wait for the first onset of sex. Wait, in other words, if you're 13, wait until you're 15 to have sex. Or if you're 15, wait until you're 17 to have sex. Well, nobody can doubt that would slow the pandemic, but it will not stop it. So those are the four most popular secular approaches to AIDS prevention, and they will work to a degree. But if you want to stop it, now you've got to bring in the church. And stop, S-T-O-P, are the four things that the church has the moral authority to talk about. And one S is save sex for marriage. There is no doubt about it that if people save sex for marriage, we could probably stop this in a generation. Because the blood supplies are clearing up. There is still other issues like needles and things like that. But save sex for marriage will inevitably, over time, stop the pandemic. T in stop is teach men respect women and children. Because even as Kay and Princess Zulu could point out, a woman can be totally faithful to her husband. But if she doesn't have control over her body, and a man can say, you got to give me sex, and he's gone out and he's gotten it from some prostitute, she's been totally faithful, but still gets AIDS. So we have to teach men to treat women and children with respect. The government can't do that. That's my job. That's my job as a pastor, to teach men to respect women and children. There is a moral authority that I have as a leader in the church to teach that. O and slow is offer treatment through churches. I wish I had a map here that I could have shown to you. It's a 3 layover that I used a week ago at the, I wanted to share at the malaria summit, the White House summit on malaria. And I said, let me just show you this. Here's a 2 days walk in Rwanda. And within this 2 days walk, I said, let me show you, here are the hospitals. And there were only 3 hospitals within 2 days walk in this particular area. 2 of them were church-based, and only 1 of them was government-based. So even in the hospitals, the churches were doing most of the work. And then I showed the labor and said, here are the clinics in 2 days walk. 16 of them were church-based. 2 of them were government-based. So without that, there were only going to be 2. Then I did a layover of the churches. 836 churches in that 2 days walk. Which is the most likely, if you have to go get your ARVs, wouldn't you like to get them at the closest church rather than at a 2 days walk every time you needed to go get a refill? There are millions and millions of villages around the world that all they have in it is a church. We will not be able, if we had free drugs for everybody today, if we had a cure for everybody today, if we had a vaccine for everybody today, we could not get it to the people without churches. It's not going to happen. The church is the only global organization in the world, and it was global 200 years before anybody started talking about globalization. It's 2.3 billion people. Church is bigger than China and India put together. People don't realize it's the only network in the world. The church has more locations than the United Nations. Speaks in far more languages than the United Nations. And so we would have to offer treatment to churches, and then the P is pledge yourself to one partner for life. And when you talk about being faithful, it helps to have faith in being faithful. In other words, faith gives me the motivation to be faithful. My natural desire as a man is to be unfaithful to my wife. I'm faithful to my wife because of my faith, not because of my desire. Because human desire, a man could go off and have 100 wives, something like that. And that's why I don't buy this thing, well, just because you desire, why should I give in to my desires? Maturity is you don't give in to your desires. That's what makes you different from an animal. That's what makes you a human being. You don't give in to every... I might have a desire to hit you. That doesn't mean I go do it. Okay? So, just because it feels right doesn't mean it is right. So, the difference between slow and stop means it's not going to happen without the church. That's why Urbana is important.
We have time for three more questions.
Lori Clark, International Journal of Clinical Physiology. On your Peace Plan website, it says that peace teams are equipped to train local churches to address the five evil giants in their community using their resources and other tools that are easily reproduced. This allows the local church members to be fully empowered to do peace themselves without dependence on outside resources. And one of your five giants that we've been talking about is disease, but the corresponding item in the Peace Plan is caring for the sick. And so I'm wondering, isn't it true that fighting disease simply by caring for the sick is sort of like trying to fight an enemy by caring for the wounded? And then I'm wondering how the church could stop malaria and eradicate it completely.
Well, let me give you a really good example of this. In the Peace Plan, we never prescribe from America. We let the people in that country prescribe what's needed. So, for instance, in Rwanda, there is a team of about 25 of the technical committee and 10 on the steering committee of Rwandan leadership. Assembly of God, Catholic, Adventist, Anglican, Pentecostal, Charismatic, Baptist. They're all together. And we say, you guys tell us what you want. And then we serve you. We don't prescribe. You tell us what you want. Because the difference between me and other people is I trust pastors. I think they know better what will work. So it was interesting is that the president decided just recently that he was going to do a new initiative on malaria, just like he'd done with AIDS. Just like he'd done PEPFAR, which Steve was talking about earlier, he was going to announce a new malaria initiative to take $1 billion to help wipe out malaria in the 15 countries that have it most, where 80% of malaria is, and they're in Africa. And then they got the private sector to match it with $1 billion called Malaria No More. So they came up with a list of 7 things that they were going to do to eliminate malaria. And Mrs. Bush said, well, if you're going to do this, you know, the Peace Plan is working on this distribution center, you go talk to Rick. So they said, the guy, John Bridgeland, who's in charge of it, he said, well, where can I talk to him? He said, well, he's probably overseas. So he flew to Rwanda to meet with me about 3 weeks ago. And while I was there, he came and presented this plan for America's plan for ending malaria in Rwanda. And I said, well, I'll be glad to present it to the committee. But if they don't want it, we're not doing it. Because we only do what they want. We don't push a program on. So their list was, number one, provide bed nets. Okay. And then number two was malarials, and number three was education and sanitation and all these things. Well, I went and I shared it with the committee of Rwandan leaders, and they said, no, thank you. And I thought, well, this is interesting. And I said, fine, you don't want it. We're not doing it. This is your program. We're not prescribing this program. I would like to know what you don't like about this. And they said, well, we've done the bed net thing before. And I said, if you don't have the education and the training and the other things, first place. Some of them will be used as the bridal gowns. Some of them will be used to catch fish. Some of them will be used for beautiful decorations. Some of them will be sold on the black market. Very few of them will actually get used. And a lady who was collecting bed nets, they were giving vaccines and bed nets at the same time. She took her child to each place and killed the child because they got too. She didn't realize the vaccines. Every place she could get a free bed net, she was getting another vaccine, and the child died. Lack of education. And so they said, you know, America always wants to throw a product at stuff. And so I said, well, what would you do? And so let's talk to the village pastors. They know best. I believe they know best. So we talked to the village pastors, and they said, the number one need is not bed nets. It's first, training and sanitation. Things like, if you don't have a toilet, how to cover up what you just did. Don't create the environment where malaria can be spread. And they said, why give us nets? Just wipe out the mosquitoes. Okay? Now, you see, in 100 years ago in Panama, in 2 years, they wiped out the mosquitoes. 2 years. We don't have malaria in Florida anymore. We've wiped it out. It is easy to eradicate. It's not rocket science. It's DDT, remove standing water, use bed nets, and good health habits and things like that. It's not real rocket science. So anyway, they said, start with this, then do education, then do health care, and put bed nets at the bottom. Said, if you'll do these other six things first, then we'll take the bed nets. So I took it to the president. Well, his team, not the president himself, but I took it to the White House team. And I said, you got it backwards. Here's how they say to do it. The people who are actually in the villages, flip it and they'll take it. And they did it. So they flipped the seven things in the malarial thing. So I called the guys in Rwanda. I said, you guys have way too much power. I said, you're changing American policy before it gets announced. And these village pastors were laughing. But there's the whole thing of just listen and don't presume.
Final questions? Rick, can you tell us how you've enjoyed Urbana so far?
I've hated it. Well, I told the people for this morning on Good Morning America that I'm very excited about this for the same reason that Kay and Steve and Princess Zulu are excited about it, is I am committed to the next generation. I just recently came out of the conference with 1,000 pastors. And I told them, I said, you know, all of the ideas that we built Saddleback Church on, I had when I was 25 years old, when I started Saddleback. I already knew in my mind what I felt would work. Nobody wanted to listen to me because I was 25 years old. Okay, now I'm 52 and authority, you know, and now people listen. But I had those ideas when I was 25. I'm not going to make that mistake. Now at 52, I'm going around going, who are the Rick Warrens I need to be listening to? Who are the 25-year-olds who have the next idea that needs to reach the next generation? And I have committed my life to helping this next generation. Saddleback is often thought of as a baby boomer church, and we do have a lot of baby boomers. But we're also the largest Gen X church in America. And we have well over 20,000 people under 25 and 30,000 on our rolls under 30. It's the largest Gen X and Gen Y church in America. I have 150 people on my staff who are in their 20s. And I meet with them separately. And I meet with them and I'm training the next generation. And nobody has a history of training the next generation longer than this conference. The legacy of Urbana for generations now, of it going out and reaching the next generation. Kay and I wanted to come when we were in our 20s. We couldn't afford it. We finally got here in our 50s.
We come as grandparents.
And you brought your grandchildren with you?
No. But they'll be here when they're 18.
But we did bring a huge contingency from the church that's here.
Thank you very much.
God bless you guys.